administrative buildings or the private homes of professors, while others, the more unkempt of them, those with sofas on porches and beer bottles in plain sight, belonged to students. Graduation was a few weeks ago. The summer session hasn't begun. Most of the houses we come to are vacant. No one is home. We keep walking. It's mid-afternoon when, a few blocks from our own home, we come to the house of Shelby Tebow. We know which is hers because it's been all over the news. Hers sits outside the historic district and is one of the last original homes that remains on a block of teardowns. It's mid-century, surrounded by brand new custom homes that start in the seven figures. There are yellow ribbons tied to the trees up and down the street. A street pole bears Shelby's face, the word missing in big black print, the sign itself encased in a plastic sheet protector to save it from the rain. I've seen this same sign around town, in store windows and on restaurant doors. There are flowers laid on the sidewalk just before her home. A kind gesture, and also a grim reminder of what's happened here. I tell Bea that I think we should skip the Tebow's house. Something about going to the home of a missing woman to inquire about another missing woman feels in poor taste. But Bea disagrees. We should go to their house because of the similarity, not despite it, she says. And I know then that she's right. I've heard Jason Tebow has a temper. I've seen it in press conferences on TV. But Bea isn't scared. She takes the lead, and again, I envy her assertiveness. Bea is a born leader. With hesitation, I follow her down the narrow walkway, up a single stoop, and to the front door. She knocks on the storm door. The sound of it is empty, hollow. It would never get someone's attention. She rings the doorbell instead, and immediately, the sound of footsteps on the other side of the front door startles me. I'd been wishing no one was home. The door pulls abruptly open. Jason Tebow stands there before us. There's an infant in his large arms, drinking from a bottle that Jason holds. He's bull-necked. He's not tall, but he's well-built and wide. He fills the doorway, the storm door still separating us. I can tell straight away that he's annoyed we're here. He huffs, curses under his breath. For fuck's sake, he says, words full of vitriol, and instinctively I step backward. Bea doesn't. She's not scared. I don't think there's a thing in the world that could scare Bea. He scowls and asks, What's the problem? Can't you read? While pointing to a no soliciting sign on the front door. Truth be told, I didn't see the sign, but I don't know that it would have stopped Bea if she did. He looks us up and down, taking in our sweatshirts and jeans, our sneakers. We're sorry to bother you, Bea says. Mr. Tebow, isn't it? She asks, introducing herself and then me. I watch the manner in which he holds that baby. It's awkward and stiff. He doesn't know what to do with it. Our friend, Bea begins, has been missing for almost a day, since yesterday morning. We're out knocking on doors to see if anyone has seen her. At this, Jason Tebow turns gray. He swallows hard, his Adam's apple prominent in his neck. I watch him. Jason is built like a bodybuilder. His arms are as big as my thigh. Is this some kind of fucking joke? Jason asks, stepping outside, letting the storm door slam shut as the baby begins to cry. The bottle has moved from its mouth and is dripping milk onto its cheek. I don't know if the baby is a boy or girl, because the onesie it wears is white, but dirty, stained with spit up. There's hardly a person in town who doesn't think that he did something to hurt his wife. Twice that I know of, he's been hauled down to the police station for questioning. At random times, police cars are parked in the street outside his house, watching him. He thinks we're harassing him, baiting him. I speak up. You don't understand. This has nothing to do with your wife, Mr. Tebow. Our friend, our next-door neighbor, didn't come home last night. Neither she nor her little girl. Her husband is worried sick. His little girl, Delilah, is only 6 years old. You, more than anyone, can understand what he's going through. We're just trying to help find them, We've been to every house for three blocks, asking if anyone has seen them. Meredith Dickey, I say, reaching into the back pocket of my jeans for my phone so I can show him the picture. We're a few blocks from where we live. Jason Tebow wouldn't know who she is. But he does. The recognition is evident right away. He falls a step back, turns slowly to me and asks,
"Did you say Meredith?"
I take a breath. "You know Meredith?" He pauses. As he does, his anger wanes. His tone softens, becoming civil, less vitriolic.
"I know Meredith,"
he says. "How?" I ask.
"She was Shelby's doula,"
he says. I stiffen. My stomach churns. "She was?" I ask, my mouth like cotton. It's gone suddenly dry at the realization that Meredith and Shelby knew one another. I try and swallow, but the saliva gets stuck in my throat. Meredith and Shelby had a connection. Now they're both gone. Is that a coincidence? Or is that something more?
"How long had Shelby known Meredith?" B asks.
Jason shrugs.
"Not too long. A few months."
"They were friends?"
"Not really. Shelby liked her, sure,"
he tells us.
"But it was a business arrangement. Shelby was worried about giving birth. This was her first, and she doesn't have a high threshold for pain."
"So you hired a doula?" I ask, and he nods. "Why Meredith?" He shrugs. He doesn't know how Shelby came upon Meredith. "How old is your baby?" I ask.
6 weeks. Grace, because that was Shelby's middle name. Shelby Grace,"
he says. His use of his wife's name in the past tense isn't lost on me.
"This one here is Grace Eloise."
"That's lovely," I say. B asks if Shelby and Meredith kept in touch after Grace was born.
"Some,"
Jason says, shrugging. From what we know, Meredith remained close to many of her clients even after they'd given birth. They'd call with questions on breastfeeding, diaper rash. Meredith humored them because she's a selfless person, though contractually she wasn't required to do anything after the baby was born.
"Were you at the birth?" asks B.
"Yeah,"
Jason says.
"It was a fucking nightmare."
"A nightmare how?" I ask.
"It just was,"
he says, turning reticent.
"I can't talk about it."
His eyes drop to the baby in his arms, and only then does he see the spilled milk. Does he notice that the baby is fussing? He inserts the nipple back into the baby's mouth, and the baby settles. Her squirming limbs become inert. When Jason looks back up at us, his eyes are wet. He asks about Meredith and Delilah.
"How long have they been gone?"
"Her husband saw her yesterday morning. That was the last time," B says.
"Shame,"
says Jason. From his tone, I can't tell if he's being sincere. I find myself watching him. I wonder if he's the kind of man capable of hurting his wife. And if he is he the kind of man capable of hurting Meredith and Delilah? But why would he? What kind of person hurts a child? There are holes in his story about the night Shelby disappeared. There are accounts from friends and neighbors that Jason and Shelby fought often, that Shelby was seen with bruises on her arms and legs. Jason's excuse was that Shelby was on medication that made her easily bruise. It seemed he had an excuse for everything. Why had she gone out running so late that night? She'd just been given permission to exercise and was trying to shed the baby weight. According to Jason, Shelby thought that she was fat. After the baby was asleep was the only time she could run. The way he said it came off as misogynistic. "I told her not to go," he said then. "It's not my fault that she's gone." In essence, what he meant by that was that it was Shelby's fault. He tried to retract that later, in a press conference, when asked by a reporter. He said it wasn't what he meant to say, that he wasn't actually trying to blame his wife for her own disappearance. But by then, it had already run in the paper. There was no taking it back. Public opinion of him had already formed.
Any leads on Shelby? B asks.
The cops used their dogs to track her scent a couple of blocks. Then it disappeared. They think that was where she was snatched. They used luminol and found blood there, on the street. Someone tried to clean it up, or the rain washed it away.
No idea who? She asks.
None yet, but I've got my ideas.
It surprises me. You do?
Shelby didn't have many enemies,
he says.
But she had one.
Who? I ask, on edge. I don't know, Shelby. I don't know what kind of person she is or was. If she was the kind to make enemies. He thinks a while. He isn't quick to say. He looks around as if we're being watched.
Dr. Feingold,
he tells us in time, his words weighty. Who's that? I ask. He waits a beat. He's already said more than he wants to say. But then he says,
her obstetrician.
Why were they enemies? I ask.
I can't talk about it,
he says, and our conversation ends abruptly there. Jason decides that he needs to get the baby back inside, out of the rain, which only then begins to fall. It starts as a drizzle, but soon comes down in sheets. B and I watch as Jason Tebow turns with that infant awkwardly in his arms and pushes his way through the door. He lets it slam loudly closed, startling both the baby and us. On the other side of the door, the baby begins to scream. We turn and make our way back down the walkway. What do you think he means by that? I whisper as we reach the sidewalk. B shakes her head. She isn't sure. We move on. We go to more houses. We knock on more doors. No one has seen Meredith or Delilah. The lack of information, of answers, is wearing on us. We're getting nowhere. But then, at nearly noon, a text comes through the group chat. A body has been found.
Meredith. 11 years before. March. I just barely make it to my 9 o'clock vinyasa flow class on time. I start by grounding my class. I ask them to find any comfortable position. There we focus on breath. I invite my students into a deeper awareness of their current mental and physical state. I focus on mine. I use this time to try and shake off the fear I feel after having just received another threatening text. I'm not used to feeling so out of control, so frantic. But these text messages have me all worked up. I tell my class to breathe in through their noses, to let the air fill their bellies, then their chests. When they exhale, I want to hear them. I breathe as they do, trying to force myself to relax. There's no one in the world who should want to hurt me. No one has any reason to wish me dead. I'm an extremely conscientious woman. I've done nothing wrong. I lead my students in a short, guided meditation. We move into our warm-up. We work our way toward peak pose. I move around the room. I help my students find proper alignment, trying hard to distract myself from the thoughts inside my head. The lights in the studio are turned down. The classroom is heated, the thermostat set to 90 degrees. There are humidifiers. Everyone sweats, including me. We say namaste, and then everyone leaves. After class, I have a meet and greet with a potential new doula client and her husband. Our plan is to meet at 11. It's standard protocol to see if they like me and vice versa. We've made arrangements to meet at a public spot, a coffee shop, in case they turn out to be dodgy. For all the horror stories you hear about Craigslist, people being lured to strange homes by classified ads, only to be murdered when they arrive, it seems smarter this way. It makes me feel safer to meet in a public spot. The coffee shop is new to me. It has scuffed wood floors, tin ceilings, and tables the size of postage stamps. I spot my prospective client when I arrive. She's easy to see. She's the anxious, uncomfortable-looking one with a belly the size of a basketball. She waits at a table alone. I go to her and shake her hand. Meredith Dickey, I say, smiling. Shelby Thibault, she says, shaking mine. You want some coffee? She asks. I do. The fatigue is taking over. Without caffeine, I don't know how much longer I can last on my feet. We drift in the direction of the counter. We order our coffees. Mrs. Thibault offers to buy mine. I don't object. She asks if I want something to eat. I get a cinnamon scone because, on top of tired, I'm famished. I can't remember the last time I ate, or if I even ate this morning. I remember feeding the kids and doing their dishes. I don't remember having anything myself. Mrs. Thibault gets nothing. You're not having something to eat? I ask, feeling guilty all of a sudden. I take the scone from the barista. She shakes her head. She harumphs. Look at me, Mrs. Thibault says, showing off her very pregnant self. I'm fat. The last thing I need is a pastry. You're not fat, I scold. You're pregnant. We take our coffee to a table and sit. The coffee shop is quiet, small. There are only a handful of people here, professionals on laptops mostly. These meetings are as much about me trying to impress potential clients as they are the other way around. If we like each other at the end of it, a contract gets signed. My husband says I'm never going to lose all this weight. I've gained 30 pounds, she says. She says it like it's grotesque, but 30 pounds is average. I gained at least that with each of my kids. Is your husband on his way? I ask. I didn't have time to change after class. I wear my yoga clothes with a sweater on top. My eyes are heavy, the lost hours of sleep catching up with me. Shelby fiddles with a ring on her finger. He's not coming, she says uneasily. I'm sorry to hear that. He couldn't make it? Husbands don't always make it. Sometimes they're at work or on a business trip, and sometimes they're uninvolved. It's okay, because the women who need me most are often those with husbands who show disinterest or inefficacy. Shelby looks sheepish. She lets go of her ring. She rearranges herself on her chair, takes a sip of her coffee, which I overheard her order, and no, it's not decaf. I don't judge. I didn't drink caffeine when I was pregnant, but every pregnant woman is different. Maybe a little caffeine is the one thing that gets her through the day. I've seen a lot of women over the years. Single mothers, women who've been raped but want to keep their baby, women who choose to abort a fetus based on the result of genetic testing. Being unbiased is important. Every woman is not me. Shelby shakes her head. Her hands are also shaking. Tiny ripples form in her coffee, ruining the latte art. I didn't tell him I was meeting with you, she says. She's nervous. There could be a million reasons why. Maybe she's just timid or is trying to impress me. Maybe she feels badly about her husband or she's terrified of the impending birth. Oh? I ask. I don't want her to feel strange. I reach across the table and pat her hand. Research shows the importance of touch on a person's emotions, their physical well-being, the way they respond to others. Tactile stimulation is one of the most important. I say, That's not a problem. It happens all the time, Shelby. Really? She asks. Only then do her eyes move to mine. Of course it does. It can be hard to get those men on board. It's not like they're the ones pushing a baby out of their bodies, I say with an empathetic smile. Across the table, Shelby visibly relaxes. After we talk, I tell her, you can talk to your husband and decide what you want to do. How far along are you? I ask. She says, 36 weeks. Most of my clients come to me newly pregnant. Rarely do they come at 36 weeks. She tells me why, how she and her husband just moved to town. She had an obstetrician she loved, but now she's 2,000 miles away. She also had a close family, a large support system, but now they're gone too. In essence, she's alone, with the exception of her husband. I tell her why I became a doula. I tell her about my experience giving birth to Leo. What I remember is that the hospital staff didn't pay much attention to me that night. Josh had to beg and plead for a nurse to check on me. I felt alone. I felt like I was a burden. After it was done, I wished I had had someone to advocate for me. Someone other than Josh, whose emotions were running on high like mine. I've since seen things happen in a labor room that appall me. My own birth experience was a cakewalk in comparison. A common belief during labor is that a baby's needs supersede that of the mother's. Women don't always know they have options, or they aren't given a choice in their care. If they are, they aren't allowed ample time or information to come to a decision themselves. Choices are made without their consent. Too many women don't want to be a burden, and so they say nothing. The mistreatment is subtle, too, and falls under the guise of medical care. Doctors do things that verge on sexual assault to me. They stick their hands inside a woman's vagina without telling her first. They disregard a woman's pain. They use forced or invasive practices. In the labor room, no doesn't always mean no. Most times, labor ends with a happy ending. Women put aside whatever negative feelings they experienced during birth because they got what they wanted in the end, a healthy baby. That doesn't make it right. One of the reasons I do what I do is to advocate for women during birth. Continuity of care is important. To have someone who is there for you and only you during your labor. I leave it at that. We talk about a birth plan, what she wants out of this birth. A healthy baby, that's all, she says. She reaches down to set a hand on her midsection. I ask questions. I learn that Shelby doesn't want to deliver at home. She wants to deliver in a hospital. I don't need any of that New Age crap, she says. I mean, I want the epidural. I don't want a C-section unless I need it. Then I want it. But I won't be eating my placenta anytime soon. That gets a laugh out of me. It feels like the first in days. There isn't any definitive research into the benefits of placentophagia that I've been able to find. But if a client wanted to eat her own placenta, I wouldn't stop her. We talk a while. As we do, I find that I like Shelby Thibault. I really like her. She's practical, not pretentious. She's matter of fact. She's young, and it shows. I was once young, too. She has dreams for the rest of her life. She likes helping people. She's not working now that she and her husband have relocated, but when she's able, she wants to get back to work. Her husband doesn't want her to work. He likes it better when she's home. Tell me about your husband, I say. It feels like a good transition. What about him? Oh, I don't know, I say. Anything. Her husband is an insurance agent, she tells me. He was a linebacker in college. He wanted to go pro until a knee injury sidelined him. He's still bent out of shape about it. He's 3 years older than her. They started dating in high school when she was a freshman and he a senior. When she turned 18, they got married. Shelby never went to college. She tells me how much he loves kids, how he'll be a great father one day. I just don't get the sense that one day means 4 weeks from now, when their baby is due to arrive. After a while, she gets down to brass tacks. She isn't sure she can trust her husband to be there for her during the birth, physically, emotionally, or otherwise. He's kind of hardcore, as she calls him. I'm not sure what she means by that. But it's why she needs me there. The next time I see Shelby is 2 days later. We meet again at the same coffee shop. This time I offer to buy her coffee, but she says no, she can't stay. She's jumpy. She brings the signed contract. She presses it into my hand. I take it. Both she and her husband have signed the document. You were able to get him on board, I say, smiling. He had his reservations, she says. Shelby doesn't smile. Like what? She waits a beat before she tells me. He thinks you're a con. He thinks you're ripping us off. He looked up people in your line of work. He wants to know why you charge so much. At first, he said I was out of my damn mind if I thought we were going to pay that much for a babysitter. An image of her husband forms. Cynical, candid, lacking trust. I've been asked this question before. I'm not agency-based or hospital-based. I work alone, which is the reason my fees may be more than most. I provide services not everyone provides. You don't get just any doula when you go into labor, dependent on who's on call. You get me. He found one online that charged only $300, Shelby says. But I said I didn't want that one. I want you. Why is that? I ask. Shelby doesn't know me from a bar of soap. Why would she pick me over any other doula? She shrugs. She smiles. I like you, she says. But Jason said if I could talk you down to 1,000, that would be even better. Talk me down to 1,000? Or even 800. I mean, he's right. It's a lot of money for one day of work. I have a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach. I don't like where this conversation is headed. It's not one day of work. It's a prenatal appointment, meetings like this, the labor and delivery, a postnatal visit, endless phone calls and texts. It's also my livelihood, me putting my own life and family on hold for hers. I don't tell her that. I'm sorry, Shelby, but I don't negotiate on my fees. Another shrug, another smile, this one far more brazen. I get the sense that there's more to this woman than I originally thought. For as nervous as she was the other day, there's none of it today. Today she is assertive and sure. Which side of her am I to believe is true? Yeah, well, she says, it doesn't matter. I got him on board either way, didn't I? What I notice is that Shelby wears sunglasses, though we're inside, and outside the day is gloomy and gray.
Kate. 11 years before. May. There's a river in town. It's bordered by landscaped trails that curve around the water's edge in an area known as the Riverwalk. The Riverwalk is the crown jewel of town. On weekends, people flock to it by the hundreds to visit. They walk on the brick paths, toss coins in the fountain, get their pictures taken on any number of the covered wooden bridges that pass over the river. In the heart of downtown, the paths are maintained with ample lighting, an abundance of flowers and pristine landscaping. Nary a weed grows there. The streets nearby are all upscale boutiques. The number of bars and restaurants in our downtown nears 50. On weekends, it's exasperating trying to find a place to park. But the farther from downtown you get, the river's edge turns woody. The wide, well-kept paths metamorphose into a desire line created by years of erosion from people who pass through, feet wearing away the land. The path becomes narrow, just a ribbon of dirt that cuts through the grass and weeds, enmeshed in trees. This time of year, the area is mosquito-infested. The excessive rain and flooding are the cause of this. Mosquitoes breed in damp conditions. They lay their eggs in stagnant water, like puddles. Because of the heavy tree coverage, the puddles never have a chance to fully dry out, and so the land stays muddy, mossy, the ground littered with the moldy debris from trees. This is where the body was found. Our group meets back at Josh and Meredith's house. Everyone is talking fast, sharing what they know. It's frenetic. The air hums with the sound of voices, a constant drone. I look around. Josh isn't here, but there are police officers here. Their cars are parked just outside, while an officer stands guard at the door. Other officers are inside the house, searching through Josh and Meredith's things. "Has anyone seen Josh?" I ask. "He's gone to the river," someone says, "to see the body." We all fall momentarily silent at the mention of that word. Body. My heart is in my throat, hoping and praying that it isn't Meredith or Delilah they found. We stand in a circle on Josh and Meredith's lawn. The entire group is on edge and feeling anguished and defeated. The rain has slowed to a steady drizzle. Those of us that have them hold umbrellas over our heads to repel the rain. The rest just get wet.
"How do we know there's a body?" B asks.
"My wife and I heard about it,"
a man says, stepping forward.
"How?"
she asks.
"We were on the Riverwalk, showing Meredith and Delilah's photo around, asking if anyone had seen them. There were a couple runners there. We showed them the photo. No, they said. They hadn't seen them. But they'd heard that the cops were just a couple miles downriver trying to identify a body that was found. Hope that's not who you're looking for," they said.
We continue to dig for details, the wife says. We asked around to see if anyone knew anything. What they derived, she tells us, fighting tears, was that the body had been discovered early this morning by a man walking his dog. It was half buried in the earth. The head and the torso were concealed underground, while the rest of it poked obscurely out. It had likely been buried better, some surmise, but last night's rain may have washed the mud and the leaves away. The dog found the body first, driven there by the offensive scent. The river there is high, on the verge of overflowing. A day or two later, and the body would have been at risk of floating away.
"Any signs of foul play?" a woman asks. The husband and wife exchange a glance.
They tell us they heard the body was unclothed, and collectively we gasp. Our minds go to the same place.
"Oh God," B, beside me, says, taking my hand into hers and squeezing it tightly.
Our eyes meet, thinking of what might have happened to our friend before her body was left abandoned and alone. Thinking of Delilah. Praying that the naked body does not belong to Delilah. But also wondering, if it is Meredith, then where is Delilah?
death might be preferable to being taken by someone we don't know. Because of our close proximity to Josh's house, Bea and I go home and gather snacks to pass around to the search party, which now nears 30 in number. When we step into the house, the workers are there. The music is loud, something techno with a low bass that makes the entire house shake. They're hard at work, but they stop when we come in. They stop and stare. "Excuse us," I say, begging their pardon for being in my own home. I feel a man's eyes on me as I collect strawberries from the refrigerator, wash and slice them in the kitchen sink. It's unnerving. Bea grabs two bags of chips and as many bottles of water as her arms can carry. We go back, grateful to get out of there. Everyone politely declines our offer of food. No one wants to eat. Everyone feels the same sickness in their stomach, a sadness and unrest, not knowing what's happening down there by the river. It's all anyone can think about. I myself, trying to imagine the scene. Police and evidence technicians, reporters, yellow caution tape, a body being exhumed from the bramble. After a while, I watch as Bea pulls the midwife aside. I see them talking on Josh's front porch, where they're sheltered from the rain. I'm in the middle of talking to the woman who first heard about the body late this morning. She and her husband, she tells me, tried to make their way to the body, to see it for themselves, to see if it was Meredith or Delilah. But they got only so far before the local community service officers got in their way, blocking them and anyone else from getting too close. Many people had the same idea, fueled mostly by morbid curiosity, to see a dead body. I excuse myself. I make my way to Bea, extending a hand to the midwife and telling her that my name is Kate. The midwife is mid-50s with tender eyes and a kind smile. Her hair is long, graying, woven into a single braid down her back. "Kate is my partner," Bea says. The midwife replies,
"Yes, of course. Meredith spoke of you often.
Good things only." "I'm Jeanette," she says, shaking my hand. "Meredith and I work together on occasion." As a doula, Meredith worked in a variety of settings. She worked home births, often with the help of a midwife. She worked in hospitals. She went where her clients went, whether they gave birth in a bathtub or a hospital bed. Bea is in the middle of telling Jeanette what we learned from Jason Tebow.
"He said Meredith was their doula. It sounds like something went wrong with that birth, but he wouldn't say what. He suggested some animosity toward the obstetrician."
"Dr. Feingold," Jeanette says, nodding thoughtfully.
"Nobody likes him much," she says.
"Why's that?" I ask.
"He doesn't have the best bedside manner. He can be uncompromising. He wouldn't have appreciated Meredith being there, questioning him, undermining his decisions. To Meredith, clients came first. She didn't care who she pissed off in the process."
She explains to us the role of a doula. To be there for emotional and physical support, to empower the mother, to ensure the labor and delivery were the best experience they could be.
"Meredith is a wonderful doula. There isn't anything she wouldn't do for her clients," she says. "We talked a lot about our clients, even those that we didn't have in common. Labor and delivery can be overtaxing. The long, unplanned hours, the physical and emotional fatigue. It's heady and exhilarating from time to time, but also the kind of career that can run someone into the ground. We relied on each other for support. Meredith is a good friend."
"She is," I say, thinking of all the times Meredith had been there for me. A thought comes to me.
"Why would Shelby see an obstetrician like him, if he's so unlikable?" I ask.
Jeanette says,
"Shelby was already late into her pregnancy when she started seeing him. Very few OBs like to take a patient on that late in the game because they don't have a full knowledge of the patient's history. But Dr. Feingold did. Dr. Feingold was also one of the few who didn't already have a full practice, which should have been a red flag."
Do you know anything about this particular birth?
Asks B.
I do,
Jeanette says. She breathes deeply, holds the air in. At first, she's reluctant to tell us, but then she does. She exhales slowly and says,
the baby isn't right.
B and I exchange a glance. We've both seen the baby. The baby didn't look not right to us.
How so?
B asks.
She suffered irreparable brain damage during the delivery. The Tebows are suing Dr. Feingold for malpractice. Dr. Feingold should have opted for a C-section, which Meredith suggested. The mother was exhausted, but Dr. Feingold wouldn't listen. He wouldn't be told what to do. He cut an episiotomy and used forceps instead, applying too much pressure to the infant's fragile skull.
But she will be all right? I ask, worried for baby Grace. The fact that Shelby is suing for malpractice concerns me. Lots of doctors get sued. As a doctor myself, it's one of my biggest fears. Many malpractice suits are settled or dismissed before they ever get to court. But still, it has lasting effects on a doctor's finances and reputation. If Dr. Feingold is the type of man Jeanette paints him to be, I wonder what kind of reaction he'd have to being sued. Jeanette shrugs.
We may not know for some time. Some of these children are diagnosed with cerebral palsy. Some seizure disorders. Still others have developmental delays. Meredith planned to testify against Dr. Feingold. She was to give a deposition this week, she says. And for a second, I don't breathe. I think that this doctor did something to silence Meredith, so she couldn't speak out against him. The timing is significant. First Shelby went missing and then Meredith, the two women who were witness to his negligence. We go quiet, each lost in our own thoughts. In time, Jeanette drifts away, standing under a tree in the distance, staring upward at the clouds. I watch her for a moment. I have a bad feeling about this, B says, stealing my attention away from Jeanette. The rain picks up and then slows down. Dusk seems to come sooner than usual because of the rain. By late afternoon, it's turning dark, the clouds heavy and gray. Tonight, there will be thunderstorms. Some violent, newscasters predict. Later, early in the evening, we watch as Josh's car pulls down the street. He parks in front of the house. He stays there, not getting out, while the rest of us watch on expectantly. We hold our collective breath, wondering what Josh knows that we don't. Is Meredith dead? I see him through the windshield. He sits in the car a while, bent over the steering wheel. Is he crying, or is he just collecting his breath? I think about approaching, of going to the car, knocking on the window and getting his attention. But Josh deserves this second of peace. He's been gone for hours. It's nearing 5 o'clock. For the last few hours, the rest of us have been gathered on his lawn, holding a near silent vigil. Everyone stayed. Even with the weather as it is, no one left. No one would leave until they knew what was happening down there by the river. When he steps from the car, Josh's body sags. He trips over the curb, stumbling like he's been drinking. But Josh isn't drunk. His shoulders round forward, his head dropped so far his chin practically touches his chest. He has been crying. Though his tears are dry now, the evidence is written all over his face. The redness and the swollen eyes. He looks a decade older than he did this morning and entirely spent. There's dirt on his hands and on the knees of his pants. He makes his way to us, but partway across the lawn, he stops. He leans heavily against a tree, burying his face into his hands as if he can't go on. There he sobs, his whole body convulsing. And 20 feet away, B wraps her arms around me, steadying me so I too don't collapse. The worst has happened. Meredith is dead. No one goes to him. We all stand by and let him have this cry.
many among us begin to cry too. My hand goes to my mouth, expecting all the emotion that's welled up inside me to come flooding out. But it doesn't. I hold it inside, focusing instead on what needs to be done. We need to find Delilah. The search for her needs to be amped up. We can't stand around and mourn Meredith's loss when we have Delilah to find. Behind me, Bea quietly cries. We've switched roles. Usually I'm the more emotional, Bea the logical, the one orchestrating plans. But Bea and Meredith were close. Bea and Delilah were close. There will be a funeral. Arrangements will have to be made. Bea and I will help Josh with the arrangements. He shouldn't have to do that alone. He'll be completely beside himself now that Meredith is dead. Those words get trapped in my head. They're incomprehensible to me. Meredith is dead. They don't belong together. But when Josh finally manages to collect himself, he tells us,
"It's not her."
He chokes out.
"What do you mean it's not her?" someone asks.
"The body,"
he says.
"It wasn't Meredith. It was that Tebow woman."
He cries out, and God help me, I feel the greatest sense of relief. My knees buckle, and only then do the tears come. Tears of relief that it's Shelby and not Meredith. He tells us how Mr. Tebow came down to the station and identified her body.
"What happened to her?" someone asks. "How did she die?"
It's a question we all want to know, but only one of us has the nerve to ask.
"We won't know until after the autopsy,"
Josh says. But he tells us that Shelby's death is being investigated as a homicide. It was clear that foul play was to blame. Everyone gasps, then falls silent. Just then, a plainclothes officer steps out of Josh and Meredith's house. A woman, a brunette with strong features, an angular jawline, straight nose, jutting cheekbones. Her lips are thin, her eyes narrow, cheeks taut. She could be pretty if she smiled. She wears a pantsuit, a holster with a handgun tucked beneath the jacket of it. The wind blows, pulling the plackets of her jacket apart, and I see it. The gun. She crosses the lawn for Josh, some male detective with a lesser pay grade following behind. Stupidly, I think that she is going to comfort Josh, to give him some statistic, to say something reassuring about investigations like this. But instead, when she speaks, her voice is flat and comfortless.
"Mr. Dickey," she says. "Detective Rawlings." She flashes a badge. "If you wouldn't mind stepping inside with us for a minute," while making a motion toward Josh's home behind him.
I look. It's a beautiful home. A blue Queen Anne, over a century old. It's large and ornate, with round towers and cone-shaped roofs that give the impression of a small castle. As long as we've lived here, Josh and Meredith have lived here. Josh stands upright. He wipes at his eyes, dries the remaining tears. Everyone else stands at attention and leans in to listen. Josh looks around. He sees the mass of people waiting there for news. Every man, woman, and child here has set aside their own day for Meredith and Delilah.
"If you have something to say about my wife," Josh says, fighting for composure, "you can just say it. Everyone is here for the same reason, to find my family."
"There's no news, sir," Detective Rowling says grimly, shaking her head. "We have some questions for you."
"What kind of questions?"
Josh asks. "If you wouldn't mind," she says. "We'd prefer to discuss this inside." A van pulls down the street. It comes to a stop behind Josh's car.
We watch as a man and a woman in Tyvek get out of the van and head for the house. I swallow against a lump in my throat. They found something.
"I have to pick up my son,"
Josh says. He looks at his watch.
"I have to pick him up from the babysitter. I told her I'd be there by 5. I'm already late.
Can this wait?
He asks.
Couldn't you make other arrangements for your son?
Detective Rowlings asks, promising this won't take long. She's unsympathetic. I doubt she has children. B steps forward.
We'll get him, she says to Josh.
Kate and I will get him and keep him until you're done.
She touches Josh's arm.
That'd be a big help,
Josh says over his shoulder.
Thank you, B.
While dozens watch, Josh, with his head hung low, follows the detective to his house and closes the door.
Leo. Now. Dad tells you you'll sleep in your old room, because where else would you sleep? Still, it's weird having someone in that room. No one's been in that room for as long as I can remember. Dad has to show you where your room is because you don't know. You also don't know my name. After half a day of assuming, it becomes evident you don't know. Dad tells you I'm Leo. You remember Leo, don't you? He asks. And you shake your head, which doesn't surprise me, because I'm not so memorable. He was smaller the last time you saw him, Dad says. You don't have any clothes, other than the ones you're wearing, which came from the hospital's clothes closet. They were donated. I can tell by looking at them that they're not new. You're wearing someone else's old clothes. But the only clothes in your closet are a kid's size 6, because that's the size you wore when you were taken. They're not going to fit. Dad is tall, so he says to me, Leo, find something in your closet for your sister to wear. I still can't wrap my head around it. How when Dad says, your sister, he's talking about you. You're here, in the same room as me. You're home, or at least some version of you is home. I go to my room. I find a shirt I don't wear anymore. I find a pair of sweatpants. I bring them to you. Here, I say, holding them out. You take them. You say back, thank you, sir. I can't even bring myself to laugh, because it's pitiful that you think you need to call me, your kid brother, sir. Talk about fucked up. Just call me Leo already. Old people are sirs. You stand in your doorway holding my shirt and pants in your hands. There are things I want to know. Questions I want to ask you, but can't. Questions about Mom. I know the story the police came up with. What I want to know is if that's really the way it went down. Dad asks if you want him to tuck you in after you get dressed. His eyes get wet when he does. They're hopeful, desperate. I can hear it in his voice. He's begging you to let him tuck you in. It's been 11 years. You stare back. You say nothing. Dad stands down because of your silence. If there's anything you need, he says, just ask. Dad is as good as a stranger to you. It would be pretty messed up for him to tuck you into bed. You're also too old for snug as a bug in a rug. Dad stopped tucking me in when you disappeared. He was too busy crying himself to sleep to notice me. I lock my door when I go to sleep. I don't know what kind of person you are. The lady cop said you escaped because you made your own shank. Except she didn't say shank. She said an improvised weapon. You stabbed somebody with it. There was blood on your clothes when they found you. It was his. How do I know you won't stab me, too? I try to sleep. I can't get comfortable. I think I won't sleep. But then, before I know it, I hear Dad calling for you, screaming out your name. I look at the clock. It's 2 a.m. Somehow or other, I slept. I scramble from bed. I unlock the door and stumble from the room. When I find him, he's in the hall. He's out of his mind. His breathing is heavy. He spins in circles in the dark hall as if you're right there, 2 feet behind, but he can't get there fast enough to see you. I go for the light switch, turn it on. The bright lights hurt my eyes. I use a hand to shield them. Dad's sweating. He's got a hand pressed to his chest like it hurts. I'm not so sure he isn't having a heart attack.
She's gone, Dad says, coming to a stop in front of me.
He's wearing pajamas. Dad doesn't usually wear pajamas. Usually he wears boxer shorts. But tonight he had the wherewithal to put something more appropriate on, because of you. Except that the pajamas are long-sleeved. He sweats because of them. I ask, what do you mean she's gone? Dad grabs me by the shoulders. He gives me a shake and says,
she just is, Leo. She's not here. She's gone. Delilah is gone.
I think he's had a bad dream. Something about you disappearing. It would be understandable. I go to your room to see for myself, but he's right. You are gone. The blankets and sheets are pulled all the way up like no one's ever slept in the bed. My clothes are on the floor. You didn't put them on. I check the window first. It's closed and locked. Wherever you went, you didn't go out that way. I think you ran away, but maybe your kidnapper came and got you.
The fucking reporters.
That's what Dad's muttering, because anyone watching the news now knows what town we live in, what our house looks like, and they know that you're here. A 10-year-old with internet access and a bike could find you. I leave your room. I check the bathroom, and then Dad and I race downstairs to scout out places you might be. We come up empty. There's no sign of you on the first floor. The front door and the back door are shut and locked. Dad's on the phone, calling the lady cop because he has her number programmed into his phone. It's the middle of the night, but that doesn't stop him. There are cops sitting right outside, but Dad doesn't bother with them or with 911. The lady cop answers immediately.
Carmen, it's me, Josh, he says breathlessly.
His informality makes me want to gag. I leave. I go from window to window, trying to figure out which way you went. You have no shoes, so whichever way you went barefoot. But that's nothing new to you. I make the rounds. The windows are shut. They're all locked. You didn't go out any of them. I head back toward the kitchen. I pass by the basement door on the way there. I don't know why I look, except that I'm running out of options. I opened the door. It's black down the steps. The basement is unfinished because even though Mom hoped to finish it one day, it didn't happen before she tried to slash her wrists. Tried being the operative word because she failed. The cuts were shallow, not enough to bleed out. There were a whole bunch of them, but they only got the surface veins. Mom didn't get down to either of the main arteries, the ones that would have killed her. According to statistics, most people who try to slash their wrists fail because it hurts. That's when Mom turned the knife around and stabbed herself in the abdomen. Easy and quick. According to coroner reports, she managed to get her own liver and bleed out. She had a nasty lump on the back of her head, too, from whacking something on the way down. I turn on a light. The basement becomes yellow. I go down the steps, and there you are, sprawled on the concrete floor. At first glance, I think you're dead. But then I see that your chest is moving. You're breathing. You're not dead. You're asleep. You passed on a soft, warm bed to come sleep on the cold, hard basement floor in the dark. Because for 11 years, it's all you've known. In some effed up way, you find comfort in it, being down here, in our dark, dingy basement. It doesn't get much more fucked up than that.
Meredith. 11 years before. March. In the middle of the night, my cell phone pings. It's been 4 days since I've received a threatening text. Somehow I've put them out of my mind. Since nothing bad has happened to me, I've convinced myself there's some stupid teenage prank. Some kids must have gotten a hold of my name and number and are having a field day messing with me. When the text comes, my first thought isn't that it's a threat. My first thought is that it's a client in labor. I have two women due soon. I never go to bed with the guarantee that I'll be able to sleep the night through without having to go to a birth. It's a hazard of the job. Beside me, Josh stirs at the sound of the phone. It's a pre-programmed response. He's gotten used to this. He rolls away from me. He pulls the covers over his head. I reach for the phone. I glance down at it, the light from the screen burning my eyes. "I'm scared," it reads. The text comes from Shelby Tebow. I sigh. I prop myself on my elbows to reply. Shelby is scared of giving birth. Many women are. I was too, for both Delilah and Leo. It's a fear that doesn't necessarily go away, even after your first. With Delilah, everything went right. With Leo, it all went wrong. If I was to have a third, I'd still be scared. But the middle of the night is not the ideal time for a pep talk. Some clients don't toe the line. They think that because they're paying for my services, they have access to me around the clock. Such is not the case. My rules are laid out in the contract. If they're in labor, then I'm at their beck and call. But if they have cold feet, they'll still have cold feet during normal business hours. This is something I'd be glad to talk about tomorrow. I write back, "All first-time mothers get scared. It's normal. Try to sleep. You need your rest. Let's talk tomorrow. XO." It's an empathetic response, but one that hopefully puts the kibosh on a lengthy discussion. I'll call her tomorrow, ask if she wants to meet for coffee, and discuss. We'll make a list of her fears and tackle them one by one. Shelby doesn't write back at first. It's 3 a.m. She took the hint and went to bed. But just as I'm about to return my phone to the nightstand, it pings. "I'm scared of my husband," it says this time. I stare at those words. I read them through twice. I haven't met Shelby's husband. I don't know who he is. I do know that his name is Jason and the few things Shelby told me about him. I don't wake Josh. Josh would tell me to drop this client. He'd say that I don't need to be getting myself involved in some sort of domestic dispute. But I'm already involved, aren't I? Shelby paid her deposit. She and I both signed the contract. I put a copy in the mail for her yesterday. That said, the check still sits on the kitchen counter. It's waiting to be deposited. I suppose I could just give it back. I could say I've bitten off more than I can chew and can't take on another client. I have another 8 women due next month, same month that Shelby is due. The odds of 2 of them going into labor at the same time is good. I could apologize, recommend another doula. Shelby might leave me a bad Yelp review, but that would likely be the end of it. That's the worst she could do. I don't think she could sue. That said, the last thing I want to do is make someone else shoulder the burden. Besides, it's women like Shelby who need me the most. Women like Shelby are the reason I got into this career. To be there for women with no or unsupportive partners. I take a deep breath. I peek at Josh to be certain the covers are still over his head. "Did he hurt you?" I ask. I remember the sunglasses the last time I saw her. She was hiding something. Either red swollen eyes from crying or a black eye. I think of all the things that she could say in reply. She could tell me that yes, he hurt her, that he hit her, that he has a temper, that he screams and throws things. But abuse isn't always physical. It can be emotional, too. Name-calling, throwing insults, controlling her behavior, monitoring her whereabouts at all times, asserting financial control. Shelby used to work. She no longer does. She no longer has her own source of income. We think that victims of abuse should leave their spouses. We judge them for not leaving but choosing to stay in abusive relationships. But with no job and a baby on the way, what are women like Shelby to do? She's reliant on Jason. Physical abuse worries me more than emotional abuse. But the fact that Shelby doesn't reply is most disconcerting of all. I think the worst. That he saw her texting and now he's mad. Is everything okay, Shelby? I ask. When, again, she doesn't reply, I consider going to her house to see if she's all right. The Tebow's address is on the contract. They don't live far. They live quite close, actually, in our neighborhood. It might be how Shelby heard of me. Now that I think of it, I don't know how Shelby heard of me. Sometimes OBGYNs recommend me, but Shelby's is leery of doulas. I haven't worked with him before, but his reputation precedes him. He wouldn't have recommended me or anyone else in my line of work. I have a website. There is a database of doulas where she could have found me. The fact that I can walk to her house may only be coincidental. But it would be rash for me to go to the Tebow house now by myself. It's the middle of the night. And what would I do when I got there? Just knock on the front door? If her husband isn't mad now, if he doesn't know what Shelby told me, he would be. Besides, how am I to know he wouldn't answer the door with a shotgun? People have them. I am a mother. I have my own kids. I can't put myself in harm's way for Shelby's sake. I could call the police then, ask them to do a welfare check. But what if that would only make things worse for her? Her husband would be angry if the police showed up. He'd want to know why they were there. There would be backlash. And besides, not long ago, a woman called in a welfare check on a neighbor whose door was left open overnight. When police arrived, they got spooked. They inadvertently shot the neighbor in her own home. She died as a result. I wouldn't want something like that on me. In the end, I do nothing. Indecision paralyzes me. I go back to bed, clutching the phone to my chest in case, later on, she needs me.
Leo. Now. We don't need the lady cop anymore. Our crisis was averted when I found you asleep in the basement. Still, Dad doesn't call her off. He lets her come, though it's the middle of the night, and her arrival sparks much interest from the hacks outside. There are lights and cameras on our house because of her. Josh, she says, as Dad ushers her quickly in and closes the door. Carmen. She takes Dad in her arms. They hold each other too long. It's embarrassing to watch.
I came as soon as you called. You must be beside yourself with worry.
Dad pulls back. The lady cop isn't in her usual detective getup, but the most put-together version of someone who's just rolled out of bed. I smell her perfume from halfway across the room. We found her, Dad says. Leo did. And then they look at me, as if they only just then realized that I was here.
Oh, thank God. Where was she?
Dad tells her. Her hand goes to her heart.
Oh my God.
Dad couldn't stand the idea of you sleeping on the basement floor, so he woke you and sent you back upstairs. You did as told, though you were disoriented when you awoke. You weren't so sure you weren't still in that other basement. You panicked. It's okay. It's okay, I said, when you did. Careful not to touch you, like Dad had. It's just Dad and me. Leo, you're home. You're safe. Remember? You're not sure what safe means. Still,